and welcome. I'm Dennis Prout, Certified Financial Planner.
And I'm Shay Pataja, the co-host of
New Retirement Radio,
the podcast.
Investment advisory services offered through Capital Asset Advisory Services, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Genios Wealth Management Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Capital Asset Advisory Services. The topics discussed and the opinions given are for informational purposes only and are not intended as financial, tax, accounting, or legal advice, and are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their individual needs with an appropriate professional.
And welcome back to New Retirement Radio on WTCM. Hail, hail. The gang is all here, if not live in the studio, live from the offices of Prout Financial Design, soon to be live in our studio for our weekly New Retirement Radio. Welcome back from Prout Financial Design, Mr. Dennis Prout. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Ron. It's great to be here. Thank you. It's still feels a bit disjointed, honestly, talking into a video camera and not being there directly with you, but looking forward to that day, approximately 2 weeks, as we discussed before the show here, depending on what the legislature decides. Apparently, they're having a bit of a dust up there in Lansing, eh?
A disagreement.
Well, yeah, something like that. Something political.
Everyone's watching that one right now. That'll be kind of fun to see. I hope it works out well. Let's root for the best to win on that one, shall we? By the way, thank you for listening. Man, it's really encouraging to see more cars out there, more people waiting at the stoplight to go left or do whatever. And the activity is increasing, and we're a part of that. We actually opened our office here on a limited basis on Monday. And, you know, we're doing all the things that everybody's doing in terms of safety and sanitizing and all the rest and allowing a few to come in. But we've already, it's fun to report, having new individuals calling in and asking to meet with us. So that's we haven't seen that in about a month now, given the situation, but it's really encouraging to see to be a part of this thing opening back up again. It's motivating, so it's fun to be a part of.
Hey, today's the first day that construction workers are legally allowed to get back on the job, as well as realtors, so that's probably some of the increased traffic that you saw.
All right.
Very good.
And if Heidi and Shay want to get some work on the side and build some homes, you guys can do that now.
I bet Shay could pound a nail as well as just about anyone out there, given her dad, right?
Yeah. Yep. I better. I can't disappoint Jim. I cannot flip cakes like he can. You know, I posted that video on LinkedIn of my dad flipping a birthday cake. And it's got over 3,000 views. And so if anyone is connected to John Krasinski who's doing the Some Good News, we got to get Jim. This has to be a national viral video on cake flipping.
It is pretty amazing to watch. I mean, you get really anxious right before he does it. Like, it's going to splat everywhere. But I've never seen him drop one.
He's never dropped a cake.
And Shannon's always smiling through it, too. It's always mystified me. It's like, aren't you concerned about what could happen to that cake?
Yeah.
Well, today we have joining us Heidi Thompson, our managing executive with us today, registered representative as well.
And financial advisor.
And all the rest. We both attended Ed Slott's Master Elite Advisor Group meeting last week, so we're armed with tons of information. Hopefully, we'll keep you on the edge of your seats. And, of course, Shay Pataja has already been on with us telling her stories, which she'll tell a lot more with Shay Stats. She is our Chief Experience Officer. Great to have you here with us, too, Shay.
It's fun. Not the same as in person, but we're making it work.
Yes.
That's right.
Slow but sure. So changes this week. Learning from others' mistakes. I wrote changes because it's amazing how quickly things are changing. But this week we're going to talk about learning from others' mistakes. Now, these are actually PLRs, private letter rulings. We're certainly going to condense them and not tell the whole thing because they're a little bit too detailed for a listening audience. But there are some key components I think you'll find interesting and hopefully helpful. And if we can help you avoid mistakes, that's a key component. In fact, what did the email blast say?
Oh, Shay? The quote from Eleanor Roosevelt, learn from others' mistakes. You can't live long enough to make them all yourself.
I love that. I didn't realize that was from Eleanor. That's great. So the first case is Mr. Chip Nice. I'm not joking. His name was Chip Nice, N-I-C-E. Son, Chip, allegedly steals IRA funds. Mother pays over $500,000 in taxes. So the private letter ruling is listed. It is Mary Ellen Cranmer Nice versus the United States, October 16th of 2019. So about 8 months ago. A federal district court ruled that a taxpayer's estate was not entitled to a refund of over $500,000 of federal income taxes.
Jeez.
Paid on income attributable to distributions from the taxpayer's IRAs that were allegedly stolen by the taxpayer's son.
So he wasn't really that nice, even though his name was nice.
He really wasn't.
Yeah.
He actually passed away before his mother. The court ruled that income tax was owed because the taxpayer actually received the distribution. Further, any fraudulent conduct on the part of the son occurred after receipt of the distributions and was therefore deemed irrelevant to the taxation issue. In short, the IRS said the tax was still owed. Julianne filed amended tax returns on behalf of Mary Ellen, her mother, claiming a refund for several years. I'm not going to go into that detail. On behalf of Mary Ellen, who died in 2019, Julianne, her daughter, then brought a lawsuit against the IRS in Louisiana Federal District Court, seeking a refund of $519,502 in federal income taxes, plus interest and penalties.
That's a lot of money.
It is.
So Julianne is the sister of Chip, right? There are the two children of Mary Ellen. And so...
Competing interest here. Yeah. Isn't that the interesting part? How much better it would have been to name two powers of attorney to oversee or help oversee mother in this kind of... it's accounting. Basic accounting principles and having, in essence, accountability. Two people can often be better than one in taking on the best interest of mom in this case. The court decided in this case that the tax code provides an item of income as included in the taxpayer's gross income for the taxable year in which it was received by the taxpayer. Even though the son stole it, it was still received into her account. So constructive receipt. And it also points up to getting advice. In this case, I'm assuming not just from the attorney, but the financial advisor, as well as the accountant in this case. Because toward the end, Ed Slott has given several cures, if you will, to this. Advisor takeaway, what Ed is recommending here could have happened or could still claim a deduction for theft loss. Instead of amending Mary Ellen's federal tax returns by reducing the taxable income attributable to the IRA distributions, Julianne, the daughter, as Heidi mentioned, may have been better off claiming a deduction for theft loss. And honestly, as I read this and Ed went through this last week, I was surprised. It hadn't even occurred to me, and I can understand why they went directly after the IRS in this. But understanding how the IRS might rule beforehand and what might be a much easier way to deal with this is going, in essence, after her brother, the son, as well. Instead of amending Marianne's federal tax returns by reducing the taxable income attributable to the IRA distributions, Julianne may have been better off claiming a deduction for theft loss. Prior to 2018, taxpayers could deduct theft and casualty losses to the extent they exceeded 10% of adjusted gross income. So in this case, obviously, they did exceed that. And it may have wound up being much cheaper in the end pursuing that.
Well, they might have gotten a more favorable ruling because they had a really good case because the son had taken the money that the mom had withdrawn from her IRA and the son had used it for his own purposes.
Yes.
And Ed was just pointing out that, you know, you want to look at the whole situation and your goal is to try to recover as much of that money as possible. And they might have had a better case if they would have gone the way of the theft loss instead of just the IRA distributions never went to the mothers for her benefit.
Yeah, and this might be a much easier way to recover at least a part of the funds. Even though, as it turns out, the IRS, their ruling there may have been edgy, still it may have been much easier to seek it through tax law. Restorative payments, too. When a client's IRA funds are mishandled or misappropriated, the client may be able to roll over to an IRA the amounts received after bringing a lawsuit to recover the losses. So that was another significant part of this. And that those IRA funds could theoretically be returned even if it's beyond the 60-day rule.
So if they would have gone for the theft loss instead of just for tax relief, and they had won on the theft loss claim, they could have taken that amount and rolled that back into the IRA, and then they would have protected that money from a tax and gotten a tax deferral. Instead of having all that money being in a taxable state.
Right. And then they may have been able to recover it as well from the son Chip's estate itself. And last notes on this, this case may not be over. The court's decision here is certainly open to criticism. For example, its finding that all of the IRA distributions apparently paid out over several years were received by Mary Ellen before Chip misappropriated any of the funds does not seem to square with the factual allegations. In addition, the court distinguished the Roberts case, which I didn't get into here, by finding that Mary Ellen was at all times the sole owner of the checking account into which the distributions were deposited. While technically true, this finding overlooks the evidence that Mary Ellen's dementia caused her to surrender any real control of the account to her son via the allegedly fraudulent power of attorney. Thus, it is possible that Mary Ellen's estate could appeal this decision to the federal appeals court. Another significant point I thought was brought up by Ed in his notes to us as advisors, how advisors can add value, be vigilant for the client. The Nice case is a dramatic illustration of the crucial role then an advisor can play as a watchdog over a family's finances. An engaged and attentive financial advisor surely would have noticed the large IRA distributions that were allegedly stolen right under Mary Ellen's nose. By contrast, a $1 trillion fund company is just an order taker, which is often the case in these kinds of situations. So it's interesting to note, fraudulent activities do occur. What are some of the basic principles you can do to protect yourself as well as your estate? And how can you also protect, in some cases, your children from themselves when it comes right down to it? And seeking the advice of counsel of one, two, three different advisors in a given situation where a difficult thing has occurred, maybe the best way to get monies back in a tough situation. So I've got a question for Heidi. What was the thing that surprised you the most from Ed Slott's class of this last week? Information that was most surprising to you?
Well, we certainly did get through a lot of information over 2 days through another Zooming experience. But there was one thing that really caught my attention. And this is something that occurred with the passage of the Secure Act in December of 2019. And we've had several shows talking to you about the different changes. And one thing when we delved into some of the language in the act is because of some of the changes to the rules, Congress has now created a new thing. This new thing is a QCD that could be taxable. So it was really surprising because the whole purpose of the QCD and why it's such a opportunity for people who don't need their RMDs.
Hang on a minute, if you would. What's a QCD again, if you would just review it?
Yep, QCD is a qualified charitable distribution. So because of the changes in the Secure Act, they've made a situation could occur where that QCD could be taxable. So it just makes you smile a little bit because it's like, okay, Congress created this situation by their new legislation. And how many times do we see things like this where things get a little messed up and don't seem logical?
Yeah, so how does that make a, how could a QCD be taxable then?
Well, the situation would be very specific in that anyone who takes advantage of the opportunity that the Secure Act gave to people over 70 and a half to continue to make deductible contributions to their IRA if they're still working. If that happens, then that amount would be taken. If you took a QCD from that account, from that IRA, you would have to net it against that amount you've contributed.
It's so taxable income.
It would still remain taxable income. You would not be able to deduct it from your taxable income amount.
Yeah.
So it makes that contribution to the IRA after you're 70 and a half, that makes that more of a discussion and more of a thoughtful thing that you have to figure out, is this what you really want to do? And maybe something you could do is you could make that contribution to a Roth IRA, which is also allowed, which is not impacted by that QCD rule. So another reason why you have to, even though you can do something, it's should you do that? What is your intent? And what do you want to do with that account? And that's all discussions that we would have with our clients if they decided to do something like that.
Yeah, so it's a, it could be wind up being a gotcha moment for those people who are making contributions after age 70 and a half to a deductible IRA if you're charitably inclined and generally think of doing a QCD or qualified charitable distribution. You might rather make those contributions after age 70 and a half to a Roth IRA. Hmm. It grows tax-free anyway. You can't deduct it, but it's it grows tax-free, all right?
Question, Shay mentioned the drastic drop in airline business, and your friend Warren Buffett, I think, divested his portfolio of airline stocks. Yeah. How does an industry like that, which is, I think, a thin margin anyway, how does the airline industry survive right now and into the future? I mean, in your opinion, and is there opportunity? I mean, if people buy stocks now, is it inevitable in a few years they'll be back where they were? Or what do you make of the airline industry in these times?
Well, first of all, of course, it's never inevitable that they'll survive. So a lot of it depends on their ability to weather the storms. The reason Warren said that he divested was he thought that the recovery was going to take longer than he would otherwise like. And he owned some very good companies as a part of the portfolio too. But the other part of that is, frankly, the government help in getting these companies back on their feet again, and assisting them with advantaged loans, if you will, a lower interest loans, that sort of thing, making certain that they have the liquidity that they need, and then figuring out how to turn that back around and getting people to travel again. It's like everything else, beginning to step back into activity. And it may be a lot faster than we had anticipated. It may be slower. Trying to anticipate that kind of thing, isn't it interesting that the unemployment numbers came out today and very high, but yet the stock market is still up? Well, that doesn't make sense, does it? At least the futures were up. I'm not able to watch it here while we're on the radio.
I just, here we are, just give the live time at 10:39 here on Thursday, the 7th. I last looked, I lost the page here. They are up, the Dow's up 296, S&P's up 36. So, yeah,
I guess I just pulled it up myself as well.
Yeah, so that you said that doesn't make sense. So why is it up like that?
It doesn't make sense given the news cycle. Those numbers on the unemployment were anticipated 2 months ago, 6 weeks ago, and already, if you will, digested by those who are the market futurists, you know, those who are looking at that sort of thing. What are they concerned about now? They're concerned about the amount of dollars that are coming into the economy and what that's going to do to our currency, and in the end, hopefully, what it's going to do for the stock market. Interest rates are another huge, I would say, a very big concern for a lot. So, yeah, they're looking at things that not necessarily the journalists are looking at. Okay?
Got it. I know you've had that explanation before, and it's good to hear that again.
Good. Yeah, it honestly, it made me smile this morning, Ron, as I thought, okay, so the futures before the Dow opens are positive. And the numbers are going to be horrible on the unemployment front. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Of course, we don't know where the market will wind up today. There has been a few days where it opened up a few hundred and then was down at the end of the day by 10 or 20 points.
Right.
You never know.
Yeah, so obviously, too, on the other side of that, as you mentioned, Ron, the short-term trading is impossible to know. By the same token, most likely that information has already been anticipated and priced in. All right, Heidi's got another case to share with us called the bookkeeping error.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's so funny that you played that song. I was like, that song is perfect. What a difference a day makes, 24 hours. But in the case we're going to talk about, it was more like 48 hours, but I think that's pretty close. What we have here is a situation where someone was doing a rollover from their employer plan to an IRA, and things didn't go quite as planned. And she ended up with, after having filed their taxes, with the IRS coming back and wanting to add over $500,000 to her income for that year. So for her to be taxed on that instead. So let me just lay the groundwork a little bit as to what this story is. So Nancy, who was the woman in this case, she received a distribution of over $500,000 from her IRA held with a Capital Guardian, was the name of her institution she worked with. And so she took this money out. It wasn't a company plan, I misspoke. It's from an IRA. And she was doing what we usually call, and you've probably heard us talk about, a 60-day rollover. So this is where you take your money out of the account, but you get it back into the account within 60 days. So Nancy wanted to use this distribution to purchase a new home while she was waiting for the close on the sale of her old home. So she sort of wanted to use this to bridge that period. And her intent was always to return the amount back into the IRA before the 60 days. So she really didn't give herself that much time because she took the distribution on June 25th, and on August 21st, she got the money from the closing. So she sent the check in to her financial advisor for them to deposit. She overnighted it. So they got it the next day on August 22nd. Well, the financial firm did not credit it to her account until August 26th, which made it 62 days after the distribution from the original distribution from the account. Well, the rule is 60 days and it's a hard and fast 60 days. So 62 days is not within that period. So the IRS came back and said, you missed it. Well, this was a case that actually Nancy was successful in arguing in the tax court. So she went back to the to get this private letter ruling because she said, hey, you know, I overnighted the check to the financial firm. I don't know why they didn't credit it to my account until 2 days later. So this the IRS found that she was able to reverse that decision because it was not her fault, it was the institution's fault. But the reason I thought this was a good case to talk about is because a lot of times when you take that money out, you can see that just by missing a deadline, she had to go through all the pain and expense of coming up with attorneys to help her write her case out. She had to go to court. And Dennis, these private letter rulings are quite expensive, aren't they? I mean, you have to pay, what is it, like over $10,000?
It's $10,000 for a private letter ruling. So already you can guess she had at least $20,000 into defending herself in this kind of situation from something that never should have happened.
So right. She won the case, but it cost her $20,000?
Oh, at least.
Jeez.
At least. The private letter ruling alone is $10,000. And think about the stress and the hardship that causes for her in terms of, you know, bringing this whole suit.
And her financial institution that sat on her check for 4 days, they don't have any liability or responsibility?
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
In this kind of case, apparently they didn't. And if they simply would have said, though, this money was timely deposited, and here's why, I would guess that the IRS would have accepted that. I don't quite understand. It doesn't tell us why. The financial advisor didn't get involved in this case, but in most cases or most situations where a financial advisor got involved and owned up to the issue, it would not be a problem. It would not be a problem in most cases related to that. The tax court said it could not explain why the IRS assessed that amount as it was, and that's why she appealed to the tax court.
So she was successful, but what a headache to go through. So just to show you that she thought she was fine, so she filed her taxes. You just want to make sure you keep your records or that you deal with your financial advisor and confirm that these things have happened, because just a couple of days can make a big difference between getting a huge tax bill and getting the one that you expect.
Well, let's just talk about what the tax bill was. Her rollover was saved plus the IRA tax bill of $214,333 and additional penalties of $42,867. So we can just round that off. It's about $256,257,000.
And that extra amount was what the IRS calls an accuracy penalty. So because she didn't include it, they were going to fine her additional $42,000 for not being accurate. And that just adds insult to injury in my view, but these things do happen.
Oh, you can laugh.
No, I'm kidding.
Well, we can laugh because she prevailed. It would be a lot sadder story if she had failed in her petition and she got stuck. That meant most of that IRA balance would have gone to the IRS instead of for her benefit in the future. So
the risks of 60-day rollovers, that's what's going on. The 60-day rollover can be an opportunity. It can also be risky in terms of timing.
I think it also points to the difference between working with what kind of advisor you choose to work with. So does your advisor know your name? Does the staff know who you are? Do they understand the deadlines and the things that are important to you? And so when you're shopping around for advisors, that's something to consider.
We're applying this stuff to our own practice all the time. This recent information on the 70.5 contribution to a regular IRA versus the qualified charitable distribution, we're actually, Heidi's sharing that with the staff. So this is this is information that we actually use in our practice. So it's really helpful to us, frankly. The next case is a transfer of IRA for a charitable beneficiary is not taxable. This is from PLR 2019-43020. And those are the actual numbers from this. The IRS rules against the charity. IRS says that charities too must follow IRS inherited IRA rules, even if the transfer is not taxable. So a significant amount of misunderstanding, according to our observation here by the charity, as well as their own advisors. Amounts given to a charity through an IRA are completely non-taxable. But apparently in this case, the charity was attempting to open an IRA, a beneficiary IRA account, to have the assets distributed through that, when frankly, it's completely unnecessary for them to do so. And here's the facts, and I'll share it quickly. An individual with an IRA died after having named a charitable organization or charity as the IRA beneficiary. And we see that quite a bit, actually, in our practice. In order to make distributions from the IRA to the charity, the IRA custodian, the company that in essence oversees the IRA, required the charity to open up a new IRA or inherited IRA to which the original IRA assets could be moved in a trustee-to-trustee transfer. I'm not sure why the custodian required them to do that. Frankly, completely unnecessary, but they did. And the charity, attempted to do that based on misinformation, again, I'll say. So the whole case revolved around the charity appealing to the IRS. And the ruling was the IRS denied all three of the charity's requested rulings. The charity wanted the following rulings. One, the inherited IRA would not qualify as an IRA. Two, since it's not a proper IRA, the inherited IRA would be a taxable trust. And three, the transfer from the original IRA to the inherited IRA would be a taxable distribution. The IRS ruled against them. And all three, they're simply correcting misinformation by the charity. So isn't that interesting? In the end, these organizations need good advice as well in approaching these kinds of situations.
Because it was sort of like none of us could figure out why they did that, because they could have just opened the account and then withdrawn the funds and it would have been non-taxable to the charity. So instead they went through this whole process when they could have just opened the account and gotten the funds. And so they misdirected a lot of resources towards trying to get these rulings that really didn't help them in the long run.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find us online at proutfinancialdesign.com. That's P-R-O-U-T, financialdesign.com. Also, you'll be able to find us on iTunes and SoundCloud.